Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Today is February 17th. Thanks for listening today. We have a lot to talk about. In the interest of making sure you know what to watch, whether you're an originator, a capital markets person, or just someone interested in the mortgage industry, and some great commentary, we've got a lot to cover today. So we'll start out with a little bit of a market update. A lot of economic data came out last week, and we saw rates drop a little bit. We'll talk about what that means, why that happened, and what that could mean for rates going forward here into the rest of February and into March. So we'll get with Alex and James to do the market update here in a sec. After that, we interviewed Alex Hebner and Mike Vogue about a conference that they attended last week in Dallas. It was the Housing Wire Housing Economic Summit. So we'll show you some highlights of that here in a moment. First, in the way of data, OBMMI 5.976. We finally hit that five handle, which we haven't seen a number that low since September of 2022. So let that sink in for a second. So it's been about 2.5 years since we've seen the OBMMI at 5.976 or lower. A big part of that this time around was the 10-year. The 10-year dropped to 4.05-ish. This is about where it's at now. So seeing the actual spread between the 10-year and mortgages expand a little bit right now. We saw it contract around the announcement of the $200 billion that the GSEs were instructed to buy, but that has since expanded a little bit. But because the 10-year dropped so precipitously last week, we're seeing that OBMMI drop as well. So the net effect of that is the OBMMI under 6%. So really good news there. We're seeing volume as a result. Volume for locks up about 150% of normal is a good way to look at it. So we measure normal going back to kind of pre-COVID times, adjusting for size of loan. You know, so we're looking at units of loans that are locked, and we're about 150% of what we'd call normal. So again, great news there as well. So let's check in with James and Alex and do a little market update. All right. Welcome, gentlemen. Hey, Alex, James, welcome back from the long weekend.
Good morning. Hope it was a good one for you.
Yeah. Pleasure to be here.
Not bad. Three-day weekends are great. We were just talking about how a four-day weekend would be a cool invention that might come out of maybe if AI really kicks it up a notch, maybe that's how we start our way towards this sort of utopia of abundance that we've heard some people talk about that will be created by AI. If AI doesn't destroy us, perhaps it makes our lives better in that way. But for now, it does feel like we're getting back into a better groove after the government shutdown screwed up a lot of timing of economic numbers. Then we've just had a lot going on in January as we started off the year in terms of, as we've talked about, kind of flooding the zone. There was a lot of geopolitical stuff going on. There was the attack on the Fed, the renewed attack, I would say, in the form of the potential criminal charges against Powell. But now we've got kind of economic numbers to look at, and they're potentially telling us something. So let's start with last week's numbers. And I think let's start with Alex. Like, what did we see last week, and what did it tell us in terms of things like unemployment and inflation?
Yeah, both of the big headline data points that came out last week were very solid looking, very good by all metrics. Start with that jobs number. The expectation was for somewhere in the neighborhood of 55,000 jobs. The release blew that out of the water with 130,000 jobs added. That headline number, I would say, is a little bit dampered by the concentrations that we've come to expect out of the non-farm payrolls, where the vast majority of these jobs are in the healthcare space. And especially what I noticed on this release was not just in the healthcare space, but 40% of all the jobs, 50,000 of the 130,000, were in ambulatory services. So we're seeing a really sharp focus in where the jobs are being added to the economy. And then I was just looking back towards like 2024 in some readings I was doing. And if you exclude healthcare jobs, not just ambulance, but all healthcare related roles that have been added to the economy, we've actually lost jobs. So I think that really puts a cherry on top to how concentrated these new jobs that are being added to the economy have been.
Ambulance drivers and also paramedics. That's kind of a wild stat. Like what's been going on the last few years that we've been getting along with like 50,000 less folks in the ambulances? Rhetorical question.
It's not just this month. I mean, rhetorical question for sure. But I mean, my answer would just be an aging population. I think that's what we generally see out of these jobs numbers is we do see ads to the ambulatory services, but we also see a lot to old folks, just like in-house care and stuff like that. So all the trends that I see in the healthcare space, it's pretty narrowly confined to helping an aging population. Obviously, ambulatory services can help anyone of any age that's in need. But what I've seen in the trend of the data is a lot of these are being added just as our population ages. We need additional people to take care of those people.
Right. That makes sense. You got the baby boomers getting to that point where they're probably, like you said, anybody can use an ambulance as needed, but that's the generation and the age group that probably needs it more often on average. So interesting stat. And it has been, like you said, it was construction for a while, some government jobs and healthcare was just propping up some of these employment numbers. So it makes you wonder, and you've done the math, you know, what's going on with the rest of the economy. It does seem that we're on the net losing jobs in almost every other area.
Yeah. White collar jobs remain kind of under pressure. And then, you know, blue collar mining and manufacturing both are losing jobs month over month for most of last year.
All right. And then the inflation numbers were sort of uninspired. Nothing big there. Looks good. If you're worried about inflation, if you're worried about the Hawks.
Inflation number came in at about 2.4% year over year. The expectation was 2.7%. And I think even in the last podcast, Alex and I were looking at that like, you know, it seems like it might come in a little bit lower, a little skeptical at the moment, but it did come in. 2.4 is lower. It's good. It's moving in the right direction, right? More hiring, lower inflation numbers is exactly what the Fed wants to see. So technically the economy on the headline looks a little bit better this month. That 2.4 number, it's still, you know, above the target rate. And it was really, really driven by energy this time around. So if you kind of look at it, food was up, services were up above where we'd want them to be, but energy cracking into it, it was down about 7%. So way down on gas and oil. And when you know, think about it, transportation is all running on oil. So if you're lowering that cost, you should see it bleed through to the rest of the economy. So it's a good sign. I think that's a large drop, and I'd be curious if it is going to persist. You know, these good numbers are great to see, but you want to see them as a trend, not just a one-off. We could go back just last month. We had a terrible jobs report and not good inflation. So if it's rocky like this, that is kind of hard to read, but these are good, encouraging to see.
Great. Yeah, good for rates. Certainly, it means potentially more cuts this year than the two that have been forecast. And yeah, energy is a weird one. It's a good one because, as you said, lowering energy can lower the entire tide of prices across the board because everything requires transportation. Every good, anyway, requires transportation to get from point A to point B to point C. But then you read last week, because this is a lagging number, right? The CPI number we just saw last week was a survey from a month prior. You know, last week there were, from just kind of the deep freeze that has hit most of the country, that like we're drawing on things like natural gas to at record levels. I've certainly seen gasoline increase over the past couple months where we almost hit in Denver. We a couple of places had a one handle on a gallon of gas, which was nuts, but now it's more like $2.50 a gallon. And then meanwhile, we continue to accumulate hardware in the Middle East, right? Because of the potential conflict with Iran, which doesn't do well for fuel prices. So it's a good tool to use to lower prices across the board, but it's also super volatile. is the message. So I guess we'll see what happens over the next coming months. All right. So why don't we move to this week, James? What have we got on deck as far as numbers? It's a short week because of the holiday, but we actually have a lot of numbers coming out.
Yeah. Last week had a lot more of the heavy hitters coming out, but this week it's not slow either. So we do have housing starts, both delayed for November and from December. We're going to have durable goods as well as the meeting minutes from January, which I always like to just comb through those, kind of see what people were thinking. It's interesting. Mirren has been a little bit more dovish, coming back a bit from, hey, we need to drop a whole point, to like a quarter would be fine this time around, just to see what was he saying, what was kind of, what were they all thinking. We do have the initial jobs report on Thursday. And my personal favorite number to track, of course, is GDP. It doesn't really tell you too much about what's going on for the individual person, but I always like to see the, you know, the big number go up. I think it's something I have fun seeing. And then finally on Friday, we'll have PCE as well. So preferred inflation measure will be coming out.
Right. Preferred measure for the Fed. So again, hopes of more cuts this year. If that number comes in lower, if GDP continues to be relatively steady, I mean, it is a good number to watch, especially with everything going on with tariffs. You want to keep an eye on that headline number, and it's going to have some influence on what the Fed is thinking as well. And you keep reading recently anyway about how we seem to have achieved this soft landing, right? I'm knocking on the table here because most of those articles also say that very few people are talking about it because they don't want to jinx the fact that we may have actually made it happen over the past, like the landing took like 3 years by my calculation from when I started hearing about the landing coming from quantitative tightening, coming off of the easy money, coming off of, you know, 3% mortgage rates. How are we going to get there without driving through the floor and having negative GDP, negative job growth and all that? I don't know. Maybe we did do it, or maybe I just jinxed it. But if I did, we get lower rates if we end up in a recession here second half of the year. So whatever. Feels like, again, we have some interesting numbers coming out next week and then going into March. And we're really going to see where we land as we get close to midterm elections. And we're really going to find out what's happening with jobs. We can't hire ambulance drivers forever. Like at some point, there should be some sort of reckoning with these kind of volatile jobs numbers. It feels like that's where we may get the most hope for lower rates going into the second half of the year. That's just my opinion. All right, what else we got going on, gentlemen? Anything else folks should be paying attention to this week as we get closer and closer to our Optimal Blue Summit, which is coming up here starting on Monday?
I did just have one other kind of throwaway item, is that, you know, it's tax season has rolled around, everyone's favorite part of the year. I know I love doing them, but refunds are kind of up. They're up about 11%. People are taking that as, well, part of the big, beautiful bill. There was some tax cuts, some pieces coming back, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime. That's giving a little bit of money back to people. And so if people have a little bit more money in their pocket, hopefully our consumer sentiment will go up and a little bit more spending will happen. And we'll, more spending. It's dangerous inflation, but it means more ability to hire, get more jobs going. So I think of that as a kind of a good sign. It's nice when people have a little bit back and they might be able to get out there and use the money.
Yeah, it's good for your favorite number, GDP. Consumer spending is about 60% of that number, right?
That's right. I think it'll be spiked by AI building this year. So I'm interested to see that. But it is, for Q1 of next year, I think that this will be an interesting number to see.
Yeah. Jim, you mentioned it, kind of heading into midterm season. One thing I just keep on my calendar for next week, it's not this week, but next week during the summit, actually, but the State of the Union address will be Tuesday night, the 24th. Just kind of expect that to be kind of probably kickoff for the Republican strategy for the midterms. Nationwide initiatives will probably take shape there. Maybe expect something on housing. Who knows? They've been throwing stuff at the wall the last few months, and, you know, maybe that's kind of been their trial and error with the public sentiment, and they're going to debut something, but who knows?
Yeah, that's a great call. I think all eyes are on the administration constantly, just a lot more active out there, especially in things that could relate back to our business, our industry. And yeah, Bill Pulte's been dropping hints again on social media. Nothing big has been announced there, but still talking about meeting with the home builders, still talking about mortgage pricing. So we'll see as we get into the kickoff of the election season. All right, gentlemen, as always, great discussion, great insights, things for everyone out there to think about, whether you're originating loans or you're just curious about the mortgage industry, or you're just interested in what's going on in the world as it relates to interest rates. So thanks again for the time, gentlemen, and we'll talk again next week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
All right, as promised, we're going to get into a little discussion here on the tales of the Housing Wire Housing Economics Summit, which took place this week at the George W. Bush Institute in Dallas. It's a really good event if you've not been to a Housing Wire event in general. The Housing Economics Summit, I think, is really good for anybody in our industry, whether it's housing, real estate, or mortgage. I had the honor of moderating there last year and really had fantastic time, learned a lot, met a lot of good people there. And this year, we were represented by two people, the great Mike Vogue, who talked to Clayton Collins about the hidden forces driving lender margins and borrower rates. So in a minute here, we'll talk with Mike through the highlights and the wisdom of what that session had to tell everybody. And we also had Optimal Insights' own master contributor, Alex Hebner, on the scene. Alex picked up some great insights from the event. We'll talk to him about those. So welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, good morning, Jim.
Thanks for being here, Jim.
Let's start with Alex. You know, a lot going on. Barry Habib, Logan Modishami always present in the early hours of this event. And there's a ton of great speakers, by the way, that get tapped for this event. But what were the highlights in general for you, Alex, that you took home from some of the sessions that you sat in on?
Absolutely. No, I agree with you. I think they brought together a really great, diverse crowd for this, you know, spanning from capital markets to front-end originations and a good deal of just economics-focused people as well. I think my key takeaway was there seems to be a broad amount of optimism going into this year. I think I didn't, you know, attend last year like you did, but I, you know, would guess that last year they were probably much more in the cautiously optimistic camp. No one wants to go into a year, you know, with a negative outlook, but this seems to be the first year that we really think that things could begin rolling, quote unquote, normally. You know, it feels like we're always adjusting every year to a new normal, but you know, with rates sitting about 6%, with likely by mid-year, hopefully dipping down into the fives somewhere, that's giving quite a bit of momentum, I think. You know, the economy seems to be on solid footing. That was kind of Logan's big push during his talk was, you know, the economy's on pretty solid footing. Labor market leaves something to be desired. You know, we'll dive into yesterday's labor number on next week's podcast, of course, and get into the nitty-gritty of that. But things seem to be all right on that front. And just broadly speaking, there's a greater number of downward pressures on rates right now than there are upward pressures. And that's just going to help our industry immensely. Outside of that, I noticed that a lot of people were addressing supply, just in the housing shortage that we have in this country. You know, mortgage spreads have compressed a lot in late 2025, back to more historical norms, and that's helping us on the rate front. But you know, unlocking supply, how can we get more supply onto the market? How can we get new builds built and get them built for the market, the target market, you know, first time home buyers, getting people into the housing market at a price point that they can afford? You know, how do we do that? You know, and I think the key to the day was, you know, creativity is going to be rewarded. It seemed to me that the ideas that have been thrown around thus far by the administration, you know, talking about 50-year mortgages and portables, I would say most of the speakers kind of brushed those aside in favor of just unlocking greater supply. Logan put it well, you know, he like I just said, he didn't like those two big pushes that have come out of the administration so far. And he just wants to see, you know, wages continue to drift up, which, you know, in the bullish case for AI, I think, you know, as productivity improves and, you know, the labor market doesn't crack too badly under the pressures of AI, we can see wages drift up. In addition to that, if we just juice the market with greater supply, bring prices down a little bit, I think that'll be a really winning formula for the housing market.
Yeah, the supply piece is just continuously interesting to me and us. We talk a lot about it on the pod and you read about it on LinkedIn and And even at this event last year, I think, you know, some of the theories flying around were that supply is actually not the demon. Like it's supply was okay a year ago. I think the makeup of that supply is somewhat debated. As you said, alluded to, there is supply of homes, but the high margin homes are the more expensive homes. Those are not the ones that first time homebuyers can necessarily afford at current wages, right? So that while you look at overall supply and you see the numbers are back to where they were pre-pandemic, for general supply, a lot of those are not in the realm of that first-time home buyer. I mean, there's nothing out there less than $500,000 almost no matter where you live, which is at 6% rates is still a tremendous burden for someone to handle when they're paying, maybe they're paying $1,500 in rent and they're going to double that to get into a home they can barely afford. And then, yeah, the rate thing, last year, it's kind of a premonition or a hope that came true where everyone was talking about 6%. If we can get right at 6%, that's going to unlock a ton of volume. It's going to get us back in kind of more of a normal cadence in the mortgage industry. And we seem to have hit that number almost exactly, right? We're at like 6.08 on the OBMMI, which is an interesting coincidence. Anyway, those are a couple of things that just came to me as you were saying, as you were kind of walking through your experience there. And I'm thinking back to last year and what has and has not come to fruition. And a lot of things really have, but the supply issue still remains a point of contention, which I find, I don't know, I guess obvious that that was going to happen. You can't turn around and build 2 million houses and change the whole dynamic and narrative there in just 12 months.
There was one thing that I thought was interesting on the demographic front was, and it kind of builds off the point y'all were making, was, you know, there could be too many houses that are like 5,000 square feet and designed for like your family of six compared to like the starter homes. And just with what we're seeing demographically from like birth rates and infertility rates, like, you know, there could just be an overcorrection of a certain type of house. And then you think about, you know, our house is set up for multi-generational families. Are they set up for an aging population? I think it will be interesting to see, you know, if that twists at all in the future to change, because, you know, we may have built too many houses in the late aughts or the early 2010s that, and we don't have the right demographics to fill those houses right now. So that was an interesting thing that came up in the session right before mine that I thought, you know, it was a light bulb moment for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was actually just about to make the same point about, you know, if we go back to the golden age of, you know, the American middle class in the 50s and 60s, you know, average home size was, you know, probably in the range of 1,000 square feet or maybe even a little bit less. And today to see that being 2,700 square feet, yes, you know, for a family of four, that's probably plenty of room. But as Mike just said, you know, we've seen different compositions of household makeups, even just including, you know, roommates or, you know, folks with, you know, only one, maybe two kids. And not necessitating as much room. So, you know, addressing your supply to probably be on the smaller side is probably going to be smart.
Yeah, that I had not previously contemplated that very hard, but that's a perfect point, right? In the 50s, people were having 3+ kids and the birth rate now is half that. If people are not having kids. So yeah, are these houses designed with like an upstairs and a downstairs kitchen? Because there is an aging population and folks are having multi-generational households because they're having their parents or grandparents move back in with them. And that would make sense for a, you know, 3,000-4,000 square foot house. But otherwise, are we setting ourselves up for 2 to 3 to 4 person families that are maybe going to turn their noses up at some of these houses in the future? We have an oversupply and we have to correct somehow back to the, you know, the mid-century ranch style, you know, 1,500 square foot house. Let's just switch it over to Mike. So yeah, Mike, thanks again for representing Optimal Blue in your one-on-one with Clayton, but also just for representing our industry and just kind of being out there as a voice. You know, we know on our within Optimal Blue and especially on our trade desk, the forces that influence margins and borrower rates, it's a nuanced subject, right? I think it's one that is likely top of mind for everybody who's listening to this podcast. And I'm sure that many in this country aren't even familiar with how all the pieces come together to arrive at the rate that a borrower pays. Like, what are some of the factors you discussed in your session that you think are important for just everybody to keep in mind?
Yeah. You know, one of the big topics, at least for the first half of the day, was the spread between mortgages and treasuries and how that's compressed with the last year or so. And you know, one of the factors that I wanted to spend some time on was like the spread within the spread there. And so there's a spread within the spread, which is, you know, probably our most important spread that we talk about, which is like the primary secondary spread, right? So I started with just kind of educating the audience on this idea of a feedback loop, right? The feedback loop between the rate or price that you offer in the primary market. So think like lender to borrower, and then this like secondary gain or this like extra profitability that you get when a lender sells a loan to an investor, right? And depending upon the appetite of certain investors for certain types of loans, that feeds into the expected profitability, that feeds into the margin. Margins get wider or tighter depending upon that expected profitability in a secondary market. And so I educated some folks on that. And, you know, the folks at HousingWire are great partners. They let me get up there and nerd out and talk about really esoteric stuff like servicing valuations and spec payups. And, you know, definitely some eyes that glaze over. But I had a couple people, like a couple loan officers actually come up to me after my panel and were like, this is actually awesome information I didn't think about. And, you know, I spent some time talking about, hey, you know, there's different, you know, relative chance of delinquency or prepay for different types of products or different types of geos or different types of loan amounts, and why that makes sense to end investors and how that impacts how they price, right? You know, the average loan amount that we tracked in the Market Advantage last month was a shade over $400,000. And investors are paying up to $400,000 for prepay protection, right? They're making the play that, hey, any type of fee that I have to pay to refinance, it would take so much time to recap that on, you know, a point or a point and a half of interest rate reduction on a lower loan amount, because like fees have gone up, taxes have gone up, title insurance has gone up, all this stuff has gone up. And, you know, relative payment savings on these lower loan amounts is not enough to actually incentivize borrowers to refi. So people pay up for that, right? But that pay up changes all the time. And it changes for, you know, also when you layer in different geographic regions that have refi taxes, you know, different things like also, you know, for example, if you're less than a 680 FICO, well, investors have kind of made the decision that, hey, because of the lack of access to capital or credit, these guys are less likely to refi too, right? So it's all about this like relative scale of prepay risk, because the end buyer of this, insurance funds, retirement funds, you know, foreign national banks, like they're buying this stuff because they want, you know, steady cash flows over time. And these types of loans that are less likely to prepay than, hey, Joe Smith, who has a 7% interest rate on an $800,000, you know, mortgage, he's more likely to prepay on a half point move in rate than, you know, somebody who's got a 325 loan amount and they're in Florida, right? Like, so it was all about talking about these like kind of additional things that folks aren't thinking about, because people know LLPAs, right? Loan officers know, hey, that, you know, this credit box or this LTV thing is going to change my pricing like that. But it's these kind of like other forces, right? The impact of servicing and retention, spec payups, they impact margin more than the average, you know, probably like mortgage professional thinks. And you know, I wanted to bring, you know, kind of awareness to that. And then also we talked a little bit about non-QM as well, but I thought that talk went really well. And just given some of the, you know, non-traditional cap markets people that came up to me after, I think I touched the nerve in the audience. But we'll see if I get invited back next year. It may have been too quanty. So we'll see.
Well, yeah. So it's, I mean, I thought you were going to say it was they hit a bad nerve, like created some consternation in the group. Yeah, I think it's huge to come back to some of this. We talk about it on the podcast. We try to educate. And you have spent a little time at many conferences explaining this. And even, you know, I imagine we'll talk about it at our summit here in a couple of weeks. But yeah, sometimes you get people that ask a very simple question. First of all, why, like, you have treasuries and you have mortgage bonds, treasury bonds, mortgage bonds. First of all, they're both inherently almost zero risk, right? Treasuries, it is the benchmark for what is risk-free. And then as we found out during the great financial crisis, mortgages are, at least Fannie and Freddie mortgages, are essentially backed by the government, so should be just as equally safe. So why is the interest rate higher on a mortgage bond? And then even higher than that, the mortgage rate that a borrower actually pays. And you have these layers that we keep having to remind ourselves of, right? The first one just being that callability that you've talked about. Another way to say low prepayment or less prepay speed is going to be less callability. But the reason that mortgage rates are generally higher than treasuries is that callability feature. Is treasuries are going to pay out, a 10-year treasury is going to pay interest for 10 years. A mortgage, you don't know. The borrower could refinance in 8 months, and then you lose that income off of that interest payment that they're paying. So boom, you got the yield on a mortgage bond is a little bit higher than treasuries. Then add on to that LLPA's margin that everybody along the food chain has to make to originate that loan and get it done, title companies and all that. And then G-fee to guarantee that loan through Fannie and Freddie. Then that's how we get to our 1.8-ish spread that we have right now between treasuries and that interest rate. So to be able to squeeze it down somewhere to get closer to that treasury rate is important to understand how that can happen. And a lot of times it's these spec payups, we call them specified payups for things like low loan amounts, low credit, loans in states where foreclosure is difficult, right? So delinquencies are technically lower for the bondholder. But then, I don't know if this came up in the session, and this is always kind of the golden question, is how do you pass along all of that benefit to the borrower?
Yeah, it came up. One of the things that I use this opportunity to talk about, one of my historically favorite pet subjects is hedge cost, right? So the idea here that, hey, the demand for like a specified pay up is fluid. It's not always the 1 point or the 2 point, because you think about it, it's all about relativity, right? So if all of a sudden rates drop a bunch, then maybe the difference between a 7% 85K and a 7% 700K isn't that big of a difference if you're in the 5%, right? But it's at the 5% level, there's a big difference on the prepay if that's the current rate for a 5% 85K versus a 700K. So there's extra, you know, hedging costs that you have to think about. So for example, like if all of a sudden we moved into a different rate range and the TBA market is not liquid yet in a certain rate range, it's a little bit more expensive to trade in that. And any of these like more thinly traded markets, and you know, it's a similar for ARMs, similar for non-agency product, these thinly traded markets, it costs a little bit more of the hedge. So you have to consider that as part of your margin. So maybe you don't pass through the full specified pay up because you have to hedge a little bit differently to account for that extra prepay risk, right? There's like an extra like value point, like point that you're hedging here as well. So making sure folks are aware of that. And then I bounced off of that to then talk about things like how extensions aren't free, renegotiations cost money, and like how that's embedded as another feature of hedge cost as well. And that's when I saw some eyes kind of widen a little bit in the crowd. It's all related to a certain extent, right? There's it costs something to hedge. Some of these more profitable products cost a little bit more because they're a little bit more off the run in terms of, you know, high volume traded. So there's things for everybody to consider, but it also, I think, was a good opportunity to talk to folks about like, hey, if you're constantly extending locks, if you're not keeping up with keeping your files up to date in like your LOS, if you're extending things, moving around products, there are downstream impacts of that, right? Like everybody wants more volume and wants to do whatever it takes to close the next deal, but your pricing could, you know, suffer if, you know, Mike Vogt, the loan officer, is always extending something on the last day or not keeping his stages up to date or not helping get the files in the LOS or whatnot. So it was a good reminder to folks, I think, that hedge cost kind of goes both ways.
Yeah, that's a good reminder. I mean, it comes down to predictability, all these different factors. The less predictable the end state of a loan is, the higher cost to hedge it, therefore secondary or capital markets or your investor is not able to pass on as much of those benefits of things like specified payups or mission score or CRA, right? If we don't have good data up front or we don't have a kind of a clean flow through the pipeline, we have less of a probability of knowing what that loan's going to look like when it is finally closed and originated and the borrower gets their money. We're not able to pass on some of those benefits. And we could spend a whole series of podcasts talking about how a lot of these things that come out of the FHFA, for instance, like the mission scores, it's very difficult to pass that benefit to the borrower because of this lack of predictability of how the market could change or the loan could change or the borrower's attributes could change. Appreciate you educating there, Mike. That's putting out the good word. And there are a lot of originators at that conference. And I think it's a good spot for kind of all the different areas of mortgage origination and real estate to get together and understand what each other's dealing with in this kind of crazy, somewhat expensive and still just disjointed market.
Yeah, there's some interesting things I've even like gathered from just people who are more on the real estate side, right? Like, so it's a super good like conference that shows you the folks who are, you know, on the front end, not only of loan off, like on the loan origination side, but like just real estate and what's changing there. And there were, you know, more of the economist types that were there kind of talking more of the, you know, macro trends. You know, I was really impressed with like Barry Habib's section. He had some really interesting stats on inflation and just comparing things like core PCE to like other metrics like trueflation, which is something I've heard about, but I was not super familiar about. That was something that I'm going to be keeping an eye on after coming out of that out of this conference. You know, I think core PCE is in that like 2.5 range. He had a quote of that, but this other metric, trueflation, again, I have to do a little bit more research on it, but was in the ones, which, you know, I think that was a lot, it goes into a lot of his thesis of like rates decreasing a little bit going into 2026. I think he was quoting for like 5.5 to like 5.75-ish range, which I think, again, if we can get there, I think that's a psychological threshold for the market to get past the 6 handle. But I left being like, hey, I had a note in my notepad, like look at trueflation more, because I think that if that has a little bit more sanctity to it, towards like core PCE, for example, then, you know, we've kind of been living in like the wrong area the last couple of years. And you know, obviously a lot of harm can come from either too low rates for a long period of time or too high rates for a period of time. So that was something I left being like, I got to think about that a little more.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm interested in the actual calculation for trueflation, but I think what it gets to when you hear people kind of dissect some of the inflation reports, it's what is the average American actually paying more for? Like there's a basket of goods. Some of those goods get weighted higher or lower than others. And depending on where you fit in that, and some of them are up 20%, some are down 10. Like you might fit on that spectrum a little bit differently than your neighbor, or certainly someone who lives on the other side of the country. Where is inflation really? Almost like we used to use the Big Mac index. I don't know if any of y'all remember that. That might've been 20 years ago. It was, what's the price of a Big Mac? And that, if it's gone up 1%, that's kind of generally what inflation is, because it's such, it could be looked at as like a microcosm of spending on what we need to survive, which is food. Not that everybody's eating McDonald's 3 meals a day, but just that it, all the inputs and how there's one on every corner, it's kind of like the average Joe and Jane indicator for how much prices have increased or decreased. That's a good takeaway. How about you, Alex? Anything, just doesn't have to be econ, doesn't have to be housing rates. Like, what did you take away? Just some interesting tidbit you learned at the conference.
Just to keep an eye on things moving forward through the midterms. It quite a bit of the I don't want to call them the movers and shakers, but those more in tune with policy coming out of the DC circuit, or they worked for you know, New York Stock Exchange, for example. But being, you know, senior government affairs, just expect more out of the Trump administration in regards to ideas to get rates lower. And then in addition, I thought one of the things I hadn't thought about before was at the end of the day, a lot of the regulations that are keeping supply constrained are at the state and local level. So, you know, I was always under the impression that, you know, it's more about like going to your city council meetings and advocating at the local level. One of the speakers brought up a really good point about how to incentivize the states to loosen their zoning regulations, that one lever the federal government could pull would be to make state highway funds contingent on zoning re-regulation, which is, you know, I was like, whoa, that seems like quite an extreme measure. But as they pointed out, it's been used historically to force things through that that the federal government has said this needs to happen. Namely, the drinking laws at the age of 21 across the states, in addition to seatbelt laws. So I found that to be really interesting. And, you know, if it is something, if they really do want to open the floodgates on supply, which I'm not totally sold on that that is what they want, but I did find that to be a highly convincing argument.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's how can the federal government actually influence some of these zoning issues where many people don't understand that the federal government doesn't control any of that, right? And some states have been criticized. You know, you have the fires in Southern California, and some people think they're not rebuilding fast enough down there. And a lot of folks will say it's because of the massive restrictions that are put on how you build in some of these, I don't know, richer states. And yeah, the highway funding piece, like highway funding is a huge bag of money that has been swung around over the years to influence states to do certain things. And you're right. It was like, why is the drinking age in Louisiana 18 and everywhere else is 21? Because they were the only state to say, no, we'll fund the highways on our own. And same with, some of the, what was the other thing you mentioned?
Seatbelt laws.
Seatbelt laws, sure. Just highway safety. Interesting. Yeah, it would be a pretty big sledgehammer to swing, but it would probably get some things immediately uniform across the country if they were to swing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thanks again. Thanks again, Alex. Thanks, Mike, for representing us and for being out there. Glad you're home safe, and we'll talk again soon. Okay, let's wrap this thing up. Thanks so much to Alex, James, and of course, Mike Vogue. Great conversation today, everybody. Great talk about what's going on in the market and also some of the highlights from the Housing Wire conference. Speaking of conferences, hope to see you all at our summit here next week. We're just a few short days away from kicking that off out in Scottsdale, Arizona. And of course, everybody out there, pray for lower rates. Pray that rates keep dropping from where they are today. And that's it. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.